This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture proposed new nutrition standards for the meals served at schools. The proposal aims to reduce the amount of sugar and sodium in school meals while emphasizing whole grains and domestically produced foods. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack said the health and nutrition of the nation's youth can have wide-ranging impacts.
It's a healthcare imperative for our children. It's an equity issue. It's an educational achievement issue, and it's certainly an economic competitiveness issue, because if youngsters are not able to learn at the rate that they need to learn because of a variety of circumstances, we're just not going to be as competitive as we need to be.
If they're implemented, the changes would be phased in starting in 2024, fully put into place by 2029. Some school groups have raised concerns about how well they could keep up with these standards as meal programs continue to struggle with high food costs, labor shortages, and supply chain issues. Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic and Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research and a fellow in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at UW-Madison. He's the author of the book Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, The Origins of School Lunch in the United States. I talked to him last week. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Starting with these new recommendations, what do you see as the most important things that would change here if these end up being approved?
So one of the biggest ones is actually the milk recommendation, where essentially the new regulation, at least as I understand it, would ban flavored milks. So like the chocolate milk in particular, or strawberry milks, things like that. The milk would still have to adhere to the added sugars standard as well. And I imagine that would also be the rule that would get the most pushback in many ways, because not only are flavored milks very popular with children, but they're big money makers for the milk industry as well. Other, big changes would be the whole grains requirement, where there's a current 80% standard, and that moving to 100% standards, 100% whole grain rich foods for breakfast and lunch. A lot of the other adjustments, I think, are relatively similar to what we're seeing now, though the requirement for a meat or meat alternative at breakfast is a pretty big one, pretty big change. Certainly some other adjustments, the added sugar one is also a really big one, where there's currently no requirement limiting added sugars, and the new version would limit added sugars to fewer than 10% of calories in a meal. So they're fairly substantial changes over current practice.
How often do we see the USDA tackle these school nutrition guidelines?
Well, so it really depends. In theory, every 5 years, Congress is supposed to do the child nutrition reauthorization process. Currently, it's been almost 13 years since the last one. At any time, the USDA can implement changes to nutrition requirements based on changes in research or policy. And in fact, we saw that happen. Many of the restrictions and requirements that were put in place during the Obama administration, after President Trump took office, many of those were repealed by the USDA. And then many of them were put back into place, when President Biden came into office. And so the requirements themselves can be changed pretty much at any time at the USDA's discretion, but also congressional action can also influence those guidelines as well.
And it's kind of weird. You think of this humble thing, like what goes on the tray in the school lunchroom, and then these changes come and there's this huge intersection of nutrition and politics and agricultural economics and lobbying. These end up being a huge political debate, right?
Absolutely. And food is always political, even outside the classroom or the lunchroom. But the main issue here, I think, is that schools are always having to respond to these kinds of changes. So even when the changes are things that are very positive, like many of these proposed changes are now in terms of how they would impact student diet and nutrition, it's also a lot of work for schools to update, their practices when new guidelines come out. And given all of the challenges with supply chains, particularly in food and agriculture right now, it can be a pretty big lift for schools to adjust. And so that's why a lot of times these changes are phased in over relatively long timeframes. But that also then makes them even more vulnerable to political changes. That that time frame might be long enough that the recommendations will change before they even fully go into effect.
I know one concern is, well, I'll say as a parent, when I still had kids in the house, I sometimes tried to make similar replacements, more whole grains in pasta and things like that, less sugar and less salt. Sometimes it worked, and sometimes it just meant that food didn't get eaten. Is there a concern that, great, we're putting really healthy food on trays for kids, and then it's going into the garbage on their way back to class?
Yeah, and this is always a concern for schools because, the lunch program is only as useful as the food that kids eat, not the food that they're served. But there's pretty compelling research, and research that's been accumulating for a very long time, that consumption of food actually in many cases goes up, and participation rates in the program go up with higher nutrition standards. And there's even evidence that that kids' dietary patterns outside of school change as a result of the kinds of foods that they're served in school. And so there's not only real potential to affect kids' health and nutrition by improving school meal nutrition standards, but there's also a lot of good evidence that improving nutrition and increasing the nutritional requirements doesn't actually negatively impact consumption, at least at the population level.
Talking to Andrew Ruiz with the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, author of the book Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, The Origins of the School Lunch in the United States. Andrew, I want to take a longer view. You look at, as your book title says, how we got started with school lunches. It wasn't always a given that a school would provide a lunch. Where were some of the first experiments with providing lunch to kids in schools?
Sure. In the United States, school lunch programs start in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and mostly in large industrializing cities. And they're really a response to major changes in life that took place as a result of industrialization and urbanization. More and more kids were entering the school system because more and more states were passing compulsory education laws. And what schools were finding is that many of the kids that were coming into school were badly malnourished and were not getting enough food outside of school. We're not getting enough nutritious food outside of school. And so the early school lunch programs were really a direct response to the observation of all of these hungry and malnourished children that were coming into school, and were a way to address that problem, not only as a sort of humanitarian issue, but also as an educational one, that students who were undernourished or poorly nourished didn't learn very well, and they had behavioral challenges and all sorts of other things. And so it was really a direct response to sort of real problems and how society was changing.
Well, with over a century of work and I guess research on this, do we see an impact of these school lunch and in some cases breakfast programs? Does feeding kids help them learn better?
Absolutely. Research is pretty compelling that, high quality, nutritious meals, particularly when they're made available free of charge or at very low cost, have tremendous impacts on students. It has an impact on education, a positive impact on education, has a positive impact on health. There's even some evidence it might have a positive impact on reducing obesity. There's even some evidence that it might affect future earning potential. But there's very, very strong evidence sort of across the board that school meals have positive impacts on children.
As we see some back and forth now over pandemic school lunch programs, whether they'll continue to be funded and work the same into the future, I hear from callers sometimes kind of a core debate, like, yes, as a society, we need to feed these kids so they're learning in schools. Versus, well, hold on, it's the parents' responsibility to feed the kids in the way that they think is appropriate for them. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that these are not brand spanking new debates.
No, these are sort of the core questions that people ask, not only in school meal programs, but really in any social welfare or public health program. The core question is always, you know, how do we balance responsibility between, the state and the individual? And, you know, one of the things that's really important when it comes to school meals to remember is that, you know, kids don't have a choice about going to school. Like, they're required to go to school for some number of years. And, you know, if we really want to ensure that, you know, kids who grow up in this country are healthy, are able to take advantage of free public education, and are able to fully participate in a democratic society, we need to make sure that they are well fed. And so the debate is really about, to what extent does the state bear that responsibility, and to what extent, do individuals, meaning the parents in this case, bear that responsibility?
Getting back to these USDA proposed guidelines, they're not a done deal. They're proposals. What are you watching for now as parents and schools and industry groups respond to these guidelines?
Yeah, so I'd be very curious to see how the industry response looks, particularly as I mentioned earlier on the proposed milk requirements. Certainly, the added sugar and saturated fat and sodium requirements will likely draw some pushback. So I'd be very curious to see how that happens. Certainly, the School Nutrition Association, which represents food service workers, will likely weigh in on these requirements as well. And so it'll be interesting to see what that response is, because I think this is a case where most parents will likely, be happy with these changes. Again, most evidence shows that the students themselves will be fine with these changes. Schools will obviously have to adapt to them, but schools, when the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was passed a little over a decade ago and went into effect, most schools were able to meet the much stricter nutrition standards. Overwhelmingly, the majority of schools were able to meet them, and they found that it worked well for their lunch programs. So, again, there are bigger supply chain issues right now than there were a decade ago, but I think most schools will see these as meetable. It'll be really a question of how much pushback there is from the interests that represent various food industry and the sort of industry that's grown up around supplying schools with foods that meet federal nutrition requirements.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. He's the author of the book Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, The Origins of School Lunch in the United States. He was with us for a look at new USDA proposed nutrition standards for school meals.